This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of audio reading service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Nancy with
Ken.
And for the next 2 hours, Ken and I will be reading selections from the Monday, August 18th, Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, copyright 2025. We'll begin with news for the first hour and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read obituaries, then a number of features from the living section. After that, we'll read from the perspective section, including letters to the editor and the editorials. After editorials, we'll read the TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. The headlines from the front page of the Monday, August 18th, the Journal Gazette are, U.S. may promise Ukraine security. Large Gaza war protest hit Israel. States rethink using how fast drivers travel to determine speed limits. Now here's Ken with the first local article.
And the headline reads, U.S. may promise Ukraine's security. From New York, Russian leader Vladimir Putin agreed at his summit with President Donald Trump that the United States and its European allies could offer Ukraine a security guarantee resembling NATO's collective defense mandate as part of an eventual deal to end the war, a U.S. official said Sunday. Trump envoy Steve Witkoff, who took part in the talks Friday at a military base in Alaska, said, quote, it was the first time we had ever heard the Russians agree to that, end quote, and called it game-changing. He said, we were able to win the following concession, that the United States could offer an Article 5-like protection, which is one of the real reasons why Ukraine wants to be in NATO, Witkoff had told CNN's State of the Union. Witkoff offered few details on how such an arrangement would work, but it appeared to be a major shift for Putin and could serve as a workaround to his deep-seated objection to Ukraine's potential NATO membership, a step that Kiev has long sought. It was expected to be a key topic today at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's and major European leaders meet with Trump at the White House to discuss ending the 3.5-year conflict. Trump said Sunday on social media, big progress on Russia. Stay tuned. Article 5, the heart of the 32-member transatlantic military alliance, says an armed attack against a member nation is considered an attack against them all. What needed to be hammered out at this week's talks were the contours of any security guarantees, said Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who also participated in the summit. Ukraine and European allies have pushed the U.S. to provide that backstop in any peace agreement to deter future attacks by Moscow. It was unclear, however, whether Trump had fully committed to such a guarantee. Rubio said on NBC's Meet the Press, it would be a huge concession. The comments shed new light on what was discussed in Alaska. Before Sunday, U.S. officials had offered few details, even as both Trump and Putin said their meeting was a success. Witkoff also said Russia had agreed to enact a law that it would not go after any other European countries and violate their sovereignty. The Russians agreed on enshrining legislatively language that would prevent them from, or that they would attest to not attempting, to take any more land from Ukraine after a peace deal, where they would attest to not violating any European borders, Rubio said on Fox News Sunday. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in Brussels alongside Zelensky, applauded the news from the White House as a European coalition looks to set up a force to police any future peace in Ukraine. Von der Leyen said, "We welcome President Trump's willingness to contribute to Article 5-like security guarantees for Ukraine, and the coalition of the willing, including the European Union, is ready to do its share," she had said. Zelensky thanked the U.S. for signaling that it was willing to support such a guarantee, but said much remained unclear. Zelensky said there are no details how it will work and what America's role will be. Europe's role will be and what the EU can do. And this is our main task. We need security to work in practice, like Article 5 of NATO, Zelensky said. French President Emmanuel Macron said the substance of security guarantees to secure any peace arrangement will be more important than whether they are given in an Article 5 type label. He spoke after nearly a two-hour video call Sunday with nations in Europe and further afield, including Canada, Australia, and Japan, that are involved in the so-called coalition of the willing. The several thousand men on the ground in Ukraine in the zone of peace would signal that our fates are linked, Macron said. This is what we must discuss with the Americans. Who is ready to do what? Macron goes on to say, otherwise, I think the Ukrainians simply cannot accept commitments that are theoretical. Along with von der Leyen and Macron, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, Italian Premier Giorgio Meloni, and Finnish President Alexander Stubb also said they'll take part in today's talks, as will Secretary General of the NATO Military Alliance, Mark Rutte. At the White House meeting, Macron said European leaders will ask the U.S. to back their plans to beef up Ukraine's armed forces with more training and equipment and deploy an allied force away from the front lines. Macron says, "We'll show this to our American colleagues and we'll tell them, right, we're ready to do this and that. What are you prepared to do?" Macron said. The security guarantee? Witkoff and Rubio defended Trump's decision to abandon a push for a ceasefire, arguing that the Republican president had pivoted toward a full peace agreement because so much progress had been made at the summit. Witkoff said, "We covered almost all the other issues necessary for a peace deal." He said, "We began to see some moderation in the way they're thinking about getting to a final peace deal." Rubio, appearing on several TV news shows Sunday, said it would have been impossible to reach any truce Friday because Ukraine was not there. He says, "Now, ultimately, if there isn't a peace agreement, if there isn't an end to the war, the president's been clear. There are going to be consequences," Rubio said on ABC's This Week. "But we're trying to avoid that." Rubio, who is also Trump's national security advisor, also voiced caution on the progress made. Among the issues expected to dominate today's meeting, what concessions Zelensky might accept in territory. In talks with European allies after the summit, Trump said Putin reiterated that he wants the key Donetsk and Luhansk regions that make up the Donbas. European officials said it was unclear among those briefed whether Trump sees that as acceptable. Witkoff said the Russians have made clear they want territory as determined by legal boundaries instead of the front lines where territory has been seized. Witkoff said there is an important discussion to be had with regard to Donetsk and what would happen there, and that discussion is going to specifically be detailed on Monday, he said. Also on the front page today, there were two pictures from the open streets where fun is mixing with the first picture is fun is mixing with a fire truck, and it shows a young boy who is dragging a fire hose during a touch-a-truck activity hosted by the Fort Wayne Fire Department on Sunday during Open Streets Fort Wayne on Calhoun. And what it is a little boy who looks to be about three or four years old, and three firemen are watching him, trying to pull a hose away from the truck while mom grins with great pleasure watching him have fun. And the other picture, which is people of all ages play under a bubble machine hosted Sunday by the Fort Wayne Parks and Recreation. And there's a park and recreation's employee and a small boy with an orange backpack throwing big bubbles, big chunks of bubbles at each other while a young girl wades through the foam that is about ankle deep.
Large Gaza war protest hit Israel. Clamor grows for deal to get hostages freed, Associated Press article, Dateline Jerusalem. Israeli protesters demanding a deal to free hostages in Gaza attempted to shut down the country Sunday in one of the largest and fiercest protests in 22 months of war. Organizers representing the family of hostages asserted that hundreds of thousands of people took part. Frustration is growing in Israel over plans for a new military offensive in some of Gaza's most populated areas. Many Israelis fear that that could further endanger the remaining hostages. 20 of the 50 who remain are believed to be alive. "We live between a terrorist organization that holds our children and a government that refuses to release them for political reasons," said Yehuda Cohen, whose son Nimrod is held in Gaza. Even some former Israeli army and intelligence chiefs now call for a deal to end the fighting. Protesters gathered at dozens of places, including outside politicians' homes, military headquarters, and on major highways. They blocked lanes and lit bonfires. Some restaurants and theaters closed in solidarity. Police said they arrested 38 people. One protester carried a photo of an emaciated Palestinian child from Gaza. Such images were once rare in Israel at Israeli demonstrations, but now appear more often as outrage grows over conditions in the territory after more than 250 malnutrition-related deaths. An end to the war does not seem near. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is balancing competing pressures, including the potential for mutiny within his coalition. "Those who today call for an end to the war without defeating Hamas are not only hardening Hamas's position and delaying the release of our hostages, they are also ensuring that the horrors of October 7th will be repeated," Netanyahu said, referencing the Hamas-led attack in 2023 that killed some 1,200 people and sparked the war. The last time Israel agreed to a ceasefire that released some hostages earlier this year, far-right members of the cabinet threatened to topple Netanyahu's government. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich called Sunday's demonstrations a bad and harmful campaign that plays into Hamas's hands, buries the hostages in tunnels, and attempts to get Israel to surrender to its enemies and jeopardize its security and future. "The new offensive would require the call-up of thousands of reservists, another concern for many Israelis." Hospital and witnesses in Gaza said Israeli forces killed at least 17 aid seekers on Sunday, including 9 awaiting UN aid trucks close to the Morag corridor. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which runs the Israeli-backed and U.S.-supported distribution points that have become the main source of aid since they opened in May, said there was no gunfire at or near its sites, which are located in military-controlled areas. As an Israeli strike targeting a group of people in the Baraj camp in central Gaza killed 3, according to Al-Awada Hospital, which received the casualties. Israel's air and ground war has killed more than 61,900 people, according to Gaza's health ministry, which does not specify how many were fighters or civilians, but says about half were women and children. 2 children and 5 adults died of malnutrition-related causes Sunday, according to the ministry, which is part of the Hamas-run government and staffed by medical professionals. The UN and independent experts consider it the most reliable source on casualties. Israel disputes its figures, but has not provided its own. It is not clear when Israel's military will begin the new offensive in crowded Gaza City, Muwasi, and what Netanyahu has called the central camps of Gaza. The military body that coordinates its humanitarian aid to Gaza, COGAT, this weekend noted plans to forcibly evacuate people from the combat zones to southern Gaza for their protection. Designated safe zones, however, have also been bombed during the war. War-weary Palestinians insisted they won't leave, arguing that there is no safe place in Gaza. There are no humanitarian zones at all, said Ragda Abu Dahir, who said she has been displaced 10 times during the war and now shelters in a school in western Gaza City. Mohammed Ahmed also insisted that he won't move south. Here is bombing and there is bombing, he said. Israeli airstrikes hit Yemen's capital Sunday, escalating strikes on the Israeli-backed the Iran-backed Houthi rebels, who since the war in Gaza began have fired missiles at Israel and targeted ships in the Red Sea. The Houthi-run Al-Masira television said that the strikes targeted a power plant in the southern district of Sanaa, knocking it out of service. Israel's military said the strikes were launched in response to missiles and drones aimed at Israel. While some projectiles have breached its missile defenses, notably during its 12-day war with Iran in June, Israel has intercepted the vast majority of missiles launched from Yemen. Also, there's a little side article. U.S. halts all visitor visas from Gaza. A day after conservative activist Laura Loomer posted videos on social media of children from Gaza arriving in the U.S. for medical treatment and asking how they got visas, the State Department said it was halting all visitor visas from people from Gaza pending a review. The State Department said Saturday that visas would be stopped while it looks into how a small number of temporary medical humanitarian visas were issued in recent days. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Sunday told Face the Nation on CBS that the action came after outreach from multiple congressional offices asking questions about it.
Also from the front page, states rethink how fast drivers travel to determine speed limits. And an insert here is a comment, maybe back when you were driving a Model T, you had a real feel for how fast you were going. But in modern vehicles, you don't have a sense of what 80 miles per hour is. You're in a cocoon. This from Chuck Farmer of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. He's the vice president for research. And the article reads, Rose Hammond pushed authorities for years to lower the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit on a two-lane road that passes her assisted living community, a church, two schools, and a busy park that hosts numerous youth sports leagues. She said, what are you waiting for? Somebody to get killed? The 85-year-old chided officials in Northwest Ohio, complaining that nothing was being done about the motorcycles that race almost daily. Amid growing public pressure, Sylvania Township, northwest of Toledo in Lucas County, asked county engineers in March to analyze whether Mitchell Road's posted speed limit is too high. The surprising answer? Technically, it's 5 miles per hour too low. The reason dates back to studies on rural roads from the 1930s and 1940s that still play an outsized role in the way speed limits are set across the U.S., even in urban areas. Born from that research was a widely accepted concept known as the 85% rule, which suggests a road's posted speed should be tied to the 15th fastest vehicle out of every 100 traveling in a free-flowing traffic, rounded to the nearest 5-mile-per-hour increment. But after decades of closely following the rule, some states, with a nudge from the federal government, are seeking to modify, if not replace it, when setting guidelines on how local engineers should decide what speed limit to post. The concept assumes a road's safest speed is the one most vehicles travel, neither too high nor too low. If drivers think the speed limit should be raised, they can simply step on the gas and vote with their feet, as an old brochure from the Institute of Transportation Engineers once put it. Jenny O'Connell, director of members program from the National Association of City Transportation Officials, says the problem with this approach is it creates this feedback loop. People speed, and then the speed limits will be ratcheted up to match the speed, end quote. The association developed an alternative to the 85% rule known as city limits, which aims to minimize the risk of injuries for all road users by setting a speed limit based on a formula that factors in a street activities level and the likelihood of conflicts such as collisions. The report points out the 85% rule is based on dated research and that these historical roads are a far cry from the vibrant streets and arteries that typify city streets today. Amid a recent spike in road deaths across the country, the Federal Highway Administration sent a subtle but important message to states that the 85% rule isn't actually a rule at all and was carrying too much weight in determining local speed limits. In its first update since 2009 to a manual that establishes national guidelines for traffic signs, the agency clarified that communities should also consider such things as how the road is used, the risk to pedestrians, and the frequency of crashes. Leah Shahum, who directs the Vision Zero Network, a nonprofit advocating for street safety, said she wishes the manual had gone further in downplaying the 85% rule, but acknowledges the change has already changed the way some states set speed limits. Others, however, are still clinging to the simplicity and familiarity of the longstanding approach, she said. The 85th percentile should not be the Holy Grail or the Bible, and yet over and over again it is accepted as that, Shahum said. Now, under its 2020 is Plenty campaign, the Wisconsin capital of Madison has been changing signs across the city this summer, lowering the speed limit from 25 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour on local residential streets. When Seattle took a similar step in a pilot program 7 years ago, not only did it see a noticeable decline in serious injury crashes, but also a 7% drop in the 85th percentile speed, according to the Vision Zero Network. California embraces the 85% rule even more than most states as its basis for setting speed limits. But legislators have loosened the restrictions on local government a bit in recent years, allowing them to depart from the guidelines if they can cite a proven safety need. Advocates for pedestrians and bicyclists say the changes help, but is not enough. We're still a long ways to go in California in terms of putting value on all road users, said Kendra Ramsey, executive director of the California Bicycle Coalition. There's still a heavy mindset that automobiles are the primary method of travel and they should be given priority and reverence, she said. But Jay Bieber, executive director for policy at the National Motorists Association, an advocacy organization for drivers, said following the 85% rule is usually the safest way to minimize the variations in speed between drivers who abide by those posted limits and those who far exceed it. Bieber said, it doesn't really matter what number you put on a sign. The average driver drives the nature of the roadway. It would be patently unfair for a government to build a road to encourage people to drive 45 miles per hour, but then put a 30 mile per hour speed limit on it, and then ticket everyone for doing what they built the road to do, he said. Fears about oil prices prompted Congress in the 1970s to set a 55 mile per hour national maximum speed limit, which it later relaxed to 65 miles per hour before repealing the law in 1995, handing the authority to states. Since then, speed limits have kept climbing, with North Dakota this summer becoming the ninth state to allow drivers to go 80 miles per hour on some stretches of highway. There's even a 40-mile segment in Texas between Austin and San Antonio where the 85-mile-per-hour speed limit is allowed. Although high-speed freeways outside major population centers aren't the focus of most efforts to ease the 85% rule, a 2019 study from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, a research arm funded by auto insurers, illustrates the risks. Every 5 mile per hour increase of a state's maximum speed limit increases the chance of fatalities by 8.5% on interstate highways and 2.8% on other roads, the study found. Maybe back when you were driving a Model T, you had a real feel for how fast you were going, but in modern vehicles, we don't have a sense of 80 miles an hour. You're in a cocoon. And this was from Chuck Farmer as I started this article. If elected officials in Sylvania Township, Ohio, got their way, Mitchell Road's posted speed limit would be cut dramatically from 55 miles per hour to 40 miles per hour or lower. The county's finding that the 85% rule actually calls for raising it to 60 miles per hour surprised the town leaders, but not the engineers who ran the studies. Lucas County engineer Mike Newski said, if we don't make decisions based on data, it's very difficult to make good decisions. So for now, the speed limit will remain as it is. That's because Ohio law sets maximum speeds for 15 different types of roadways, regardless of what the 85% rule suggests. And Ohio guidelines are evolving. The state now gives more consideration to roadway context and allows city to reduce speed limits based on the lower standard of the 50th percentile speed when there's a large percentage of pedestrians and bicyclists. Authorities there recently hired a consultant to consider additional modifications based on what states are doing. States have very slowly started to move away from the 85th percentile as being kind of a gold standard for decision-making, said Michelle May, who manages Ohio's highway safety program. People are traveling and living differently than they did 40 years ago, and we want to put safety more at the focus. It's unclear whether any of these changes will ultimately impact the speed on Mitchell Road. After years of futile calls and emails to state, county, and township officials, Hammond says she isn't holding her breath. I just get so discouraged, she said.
Fatal blast that killed two revives debate over U.S. Steel's future in Pennsylvania. Associated Press article, Dateline, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The fatal explosion last week at a U.S. Steel Pittsburgh area coal processing plant has revived debate about its future, just as the iconic American company was emerging from a long period of uncertainty. The fortunes of steelmaking in the U.S., along with profits, share prices, and steel prices, have been buoyed by years of friendly administrations in Washington that slapped tariffs on foreign imports and bolstered the industry's anti-competitive trade cases against China. Most recently, President Donald Trump's administration postponed new hazardous air pollution requirements for the nation's roughly dozen coke plants, like Clairton, and he approved U.S. Steel's nearly $15 billion acquisition by Japanese steelmaker Nippon Steel. Nippon Steel's promised infusion of cash has brought vows that steelmaking will continue in the Mon Valley, a river valley south of Pittsburgh long synonymous with steelmaking. We're investing money here, and we wouldn't have done that deal with Nippon Steel if it weren't absolutely sure that we were going to have an enduring future here in the Mon Valley, David Barrett, U.S. Steel CEO, told a news conference the day after the explosion. You can count on this facility to be around for a long, long time. Powerful blast. The explosion killed two workers and hospitalized 10 with a blast so powerful that it took hours to find two missing workers beneath charred wreckage and rubble. The cause is under investigation. The plant is considered the largest coking operation in North America, and along with a blast furnace and finishing mill on the Monongahela River is a handful of integrated steelmaking operations left in the U.S. The explosion now could test Nippon Steel resolve in propping up the nearly 110-year-old Clairton plant, or at least force it to spend more than it had anticipated. Nippon Steel didn't respond to a question as to whether the explosion will change its approach to the plant. Rather, a spokesperson for the company said its commitment to the Mon Valley remains strong and that it will send technical experts to work with the local teams in the Clairton plant and to provide our full support. Meanwhile, Barrett said he talked to top Nippon Steel officials after the explosion and that this facility in the Mon Valley are here to stay. Spending on safety. U.S. Steel officials maintain that safety is their top priority and that they spend $100 million a year on environmental compliance at Clairton alone. However, repairing Clairton could be expensive. An investigation into the explosion could turn up more problems, and an official from the United Steelworkers Union said it's a constant struggle to get U.S. Steel to invest in its plants. Besides that, production at the facility could be affected for some time. The plant had 6 batteries of ovens, and 2, where the explosion occurred, were damaged. 2 others are in a reduced production schedule because of the explosion. There's no timeline to get the damaged batteries running again, U.S. Steel said. History of trouble. Accidents are nothing new at Clairton, which heats coal to a high temperature to make coke, a steel component in steelmaking, and it produces combustible gases as byproducts. An explosion in February injured 2 workers. Even as Nippon Steel was closing the deal in June, a breakdown at the plant dealt 3 days of a rotten egg odor into the air around it from elevated hydrogen sulfide emissions, the environmental group GASP reported. The Breathe Project, a public health organization, said U.S. Steel has been forced to pay $57 million in fines and settlements since January of 2020 for problems at the Clairton plant. A lawsuit over a Christmas Eve fire at the Clairton plant in 2018 that saturated the area's air for weeks with sulfur dioxide produced a withering assessment of conditions there. An engineer for the environmental groups that sued wrote that he found no indication that U.S. Steel has an effective, comprehensive maintenance program for the Clairton plant. The Clairton plant, he wrote, is inherently dangerous because of the combination of its deficient maintenance and its defective design. U.S. Steel settled, agreeing to spend millions on upgrades. Matthew Mihalik, executive director of the Breathe Project, said U.S. Steel has shown more willingness to spend money on fines, lobbying the government, and buying back shares to reward shareholders than making its plants safe.
Republicans strive to end EV plans at the Postal Service. A year after being lauded for its plan to replace thousands of aging gas-powered mail trucks with a mostly electric fleet, the U.S. Postal Service is facing congressional attempts to strip billions in federal EV funding. In June, the Senate parliamentarian blocked a Republican proposal in a major tax and spending bill to sell off the agency's new electric vehicles and infrastructure and revoke remaining federal money. Donald Mastin, president of the National Rural Letters Carriers Association, said canceling the program now would have the opposite effect, squandering millions of dollars. He said, "I think there should be it would be short-sighted for Congress to now suddenly decide they're going to go backwards and take the money away from the EVs or stop that process, because that's just going to be a bunch of money on infrastructure that's been wasted," he said. Beyond that, many in the scientific community fear the government could pass on an opportunity to reduce carbon emissions that contribute to global warming when urgent action is needed. A 2022 University of Michigan study found the new electric postal vehicles could cut total greenhouse gas emissions by up to 20 million tons over the predicted cumulative 20-year lifetime of the trucks. Now, that's a fraction of the more than 6 million metric tons emitted annually in the United States, said Professor Gregory Keolian, co-director of the University's Center for Sustainable Systems. But, he said, the push toward electric vehicles is critical given the intensifying impacts of climate change. He said, "We're already falling short of goals for reducing emissions. We've been making progress, but the actions being taken or proposed will really reverse decarbonization progress that has been made to date," end quote. Now, many GOP lawmakers share President Trump's criticism of the Biden-era green energy push and say the Postal Service should stick to delivering mail. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican of Iowa, said it didn't make sense for the Postal Service to invest so heavily in an all-electric force. She said she will pursue legislation to rescind what is left of the $3 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act allocated to help cover the $10 billion cost of new postal vehicles. Ernst has called the EV initiative a boondoggle and a textbook example of waste, citing delays, high costs, and concern over cold weather performance. She said you always evaluate the programs, see if they're working, but the rate at which the companies providing these vehicles is able to produce them, they're so far behind schedule they will never be able to fulfill the contract, Ernst said during a recent appearance at the Iowa State Fair, referring to Wisconsin-based Oshkosh Defense. She added, for now, gas-powered vehicles use some ethanol in them, I think is wonderful. A corn-based ethanol is a boon to Iowa farmers, but the effort to reverse course has other Republican support. Representative Michael Cloud, a Republican from Texas, a co-sponsor of the rollback effort, has said the EV order should be canceled because the project has delivered nothing but delays, defective trucks, and skyrocketing costs. The Postal Service maintains that the production delays of the Next Generation Delivery Vehicles, or NGDVs, was very modest and not unexpected. Quoting here, the production quantity ramp-up was planned for and intended to be very gradual in the early months to allow time for potential modest production or supplier issues to be successfully resolved, said spokesperson Kim Frum. The independent self-funded federal agency, which is paid for mostly by postage and product sales, is in the middle of a $40 billion 10-year modernization and financial stabilization plan. The EV effort had the full backing of Democratic President Joe Biden, who pledged to move toward an all-electric federal fleet of cars and trucks. The, quote, Delivery for America, end quote, plan calls for modernizing the ground fleet, notably the Grumman Long Life Vehicle, which dates back to 1987 and is fuel inefficient at 9 miles per gallon. The vehicles are well past their projected 24-year lifespan and are prone to breakdowns and even fires. Our mechanics are miracle workers, said Mike Dimmenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. The parts are not available. They fabricate them. They do the best they can, he said. The Postal Service announced in 2022 it would deploy at least 66,000 electric vehicles by 2028, including commercial off-the-shelf models. After years of deliberation and criticism, it was moving too slowly to reduce emissions.
For baseball mascots, summer gets too hot, Associated Press article, Dateline Philadelphia. The Philly fanatic has a boozy little secret for surviving the dog days of summer. Vodka and water, neat, hold the lemon. Not for hydration, he's a milk guy, jokes Tom Burgoyne, who brings the fanatic to life. Burgoyne, officially known as the mascot's best friend, works up a mighty sweat dancing on dugouts during Philadelphia's steamy summer nights. Lysol or Febreze used to be the go-tos for keeping the stench under control. Most mascots these days order off the happy hour menu when they really want to feel fresh and clean on the inside. Now, a big thing in the mascot world is vodka and water, Burgoyne said. You put it in half and half, maybe a third vodka, the rest water, put it in a squeegee bottle, and then you can spray your head that way, and sometimes that takes the smell away. Sports fans around the globe get their kicks from all the costume creatures, great and small, that entertain no matter how red hot it gets under that heavy honker. The Fanatic, Fred Bird, and Clark the Cub all need a respite from the sweltering heat, which includes frequent breaks, constant hydration, cooling materials, and proper ventilation. Keeping those performers from overheating is top of the mind for Mitch Maxine. His company, BAM Mascots, designs and manufactures all sorts of bears, birds, sea creatures, and monsters for sports teams at all levels. He understands a good mascot is more than just fabric and fur. In terms of the actual manufacturing of the costumes, they're just hot, Maxine said. In terms of how we build it, or what we make out of it, that's how to reduce that level of heat. The problem is the movement of air or lack thereof, Maxine says. If I make a costume, even if I make it out of very light, thin material, if I wear it in the middle of the heat, unless there's something to move air through the material and across my skin, I'm going to be hot, he said. BAM is among the mascot manufacturers that strategically place vents or a battery-operated fan to circulate fresh air and expel stale air and heat inside the head. Lightweight, durable fabrics are used to wick away moisture and inconspicuous ventilation ports. Think of those fabric screens on the eyes, nose, mouth, and ears that can provide fresh air. Maxine also suggests cooling vests that can help regulate body temperatures. The Fanatics suit doesn't include any vents or fans, but the 59-year-old Burgoyne, who started performing as the Fanatic at the old Veterans Stadium in the late 1980s, has his own dressing room inside the bowels of Citizens Park Bank Park and can scamper away for a quick rest.
100 days in, shape of Leo XIV's papacy emerges, calm, traditional. When Pope Leo XIV surprised tens of thousands of young people at a recent Holy Year celebration with an impromptu Pope-mobile romp around St. Peter's Square, it almost seemed as if some of the informal spontaneity that characterized Pope Francis's 12-year papacy had returned to the Vatican. But the message Leo delivered that night was all his own, in seamless English, Spanish, and Italian. Leo told the young people that they were the salt of the earth, the light of the world. He urged them to spread their hope, faith in Christ, and their cries for peace wherever they go. As Robert Prevost marks his 100th day as Pope Leo this weekend, the contours of his pontificate have come into relief, primarily where he shows continuity with Francis and where he signals change. Perhaps the biggest takeaway is that after 12 sometime turbulent years under Francis, a certain calm and reserve have returned to the papacy. Leo seems eager above all to avoid polemics or making the papacy about himself and wants instead to focus on Christ and peace. One person says that even those who really know Pope Francis always kind of held their breath a little bit. You didn't know what was going to come out next and or what he was going to do. Leo has certainly gone out of his way in his first 100 days to try to heal divisions that deepened during Francis's pontificate, offering messages of unity and avoiding controversy at almost every turn. Even his signature issue, confronting the promise and peril posed by artificial intelligence, is something that conservatives and progressives alike agree is important. Francis's emphasis on caring for the environment and migrants often alienated conservatives. Closer to home, Leo offered the Holy See bureaucracy a reassuring conciliatory message after Francis's occasionally authoritarian style rubbed some in the Vatican the wrong way. Popes come and go, but the Curia remains, Leo told Vatican officials soon after his May 8th election. Leo, though, has cemented Francis's environmental legacy by celebrating the first ever ecologically inspired Mass. He has furthered that legacy by giving the go-ahead for a Vatican to turn a 1,000-acre field north of Rome into a vast solar farm that should generate enough electricity to meet the Vatican City's needs and turn it into the world's first carbon-neutral state. He has fine-tuned financial transparency regulations that Francis initiated, tweaked some other decrees to give them consistency and logic, and confirmed Francis in deciding to declare one of the 19th century's most influential saints, John Henry Newman, a doctor of the church. Compared to President Trump, The other American world leader, who took office in 2025 with a flurry of Sharpie pen executive degrees, Leo has eased into his new job, slowly, deliberately, and quietly, almost trying not to draw attention to himself. At 69, he seems to know that he has time on his side and that after Francis's revolutionary papacy, the church might need a bit of a breather. One Vatican official who knows Leo said he expects his papacy will have the effect of a calming rain, and that's R-A-I-N, a rain on the church. Maria Isabel Ibarracena Cuarte, a Peruvian member of the Catholic Charismatic Group, said it was precisely Leo's quiet emphasis on church traditions, its sacraments, and love of Christ that drew her and upward of 1 million young people to Rome for a special jubilee this week. Ibarracena said Francis had confused young people like her with his outreach to the LGBTQ+ Catholics and approval of blessings for same-sex couples. Such gestures went beyond what a pope was supposed to do and what the church taught, she thought. Leo, she said, has emphasized that marriage is a sacrament between men and women. Francis was ambiguous, but he is firm, she said. From his very first appearance on the loggia of St. Peter's Basilica, Leo has insisted he is first and foremost a son of Augustine, St. Augustine. It was a reference to the 5th century theological and devotional giant of early Christianity, St. Augustine of Hippo, who inspired the 13th century religious Augustinian order as a community of mendicant friars. Like other big mendicant orders of the early church, the Franciscans, Dominicans, and Carmelites, the Augustinians spread across Christian Europe over the centuries, and today Augustinian spirituality is rooted in a deep interior life of prayer, living in community, and journeying together in truth, in search of truth in God. In nearly every speech or homily since May 8th election, Leo has cited Augustine in one way or another. He says, I see a kind of Augustinian flavor in the way that he presents things, said Hughes, a theology professor who is an Augustine scholar. Leo is very much a product of Francis' papacy. Francis named Prevost Bishop of Chichileo, Peru in 2014 and then moved him to head one of the most important Vatican jobs in 2023, vetting bishop nominations. In retrospect, it seems Francis had his eye on Prevost as a possible successor. Given Francis's stump speech before his 2013 conclave that elected him Pope and then Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio essentially described Prevost in identifying the church's mission today. He said the church was called to go outside of itself and go to the peripheries, not just a geographic but also an existential peripheries. Prevost, who hails from Chicago, spent his adult life as a missionary in Peru, eventually becoming Bishop of Chichileo. He is the incarnation, the unity of difference, because he comes from the center, but he lives in the peripheries, said Emil Cicuda, Secretary of the Pontifical Commission for Latin America.
And now news briefs from around our nation and the world. 3 slain at club in New York City. Up to 4 shooters are likely. A club shooting in the New York City borough of Brooklyn early Sunday left 3 people dead and 9 others wounded in a year of record low gun violence in the city. Investigators believe up to 4 shooters opened fire at the Taste in the City Lounge in Crown Heights after a dispute just before 3:30 a.m. The violence appeared to be gang-related, Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch told reporters. There are no immediate arrests. At a news briefing, Tisch called the killings a tragic, senseless act of violence. The crime is the second mass shooting within weeks in New York City during a year that has otherwise seen declining gun violence. On July 29th, a man stalked through a Manhattan office tower with a rifle, wounding one person and killing 4 others. A New York City police officer was among those who died. Erin grows in size even as winds diminish. Hurricane Erin weakened to a Category 3 hurricane Sunday as its outer banks continued to lash the Virgin Islands, its outer bands continued to lash the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico with heavy rains and tropical storm force winds. While Erin's maximum winds diminished, the storm's overall size grew, and forecasters issued tropical storm warnings for the Turk and Caicos Islands and the southwest Bahamas. The storm wasn't expected to directly impact the U.S. East Coast, but by doubling or tripling in size, it could bring rip currents all along the coast. Gusty winds and flooding tides could wash out other parts of the highway that connects the North Carolina Outer Banks by midweek, the National Weather Service said. Erin, the first Atlantic hurricane of 2025, reached Category 5 status Saturday with maximum winds of 160 mile per hour before weakening. Air Canada staff defy back-to-work order. Air Canada said it suspended plans to restart operations on Sunday after the union representing 10,000 flight attendants said it will defy a return-to-work order. The strike was already affecting about 130,000 travelers around the world per day during the peak summer travel season. The Canada Industrial Relations Board ordered airline staff back to work at 2 p.m. on Sunday after the government intervened, and Air Canada said it planned to resume flights Sunday evening. Canada's largest airline now says it will resume flights that evening. And finally, Terrence Stamp, the British actor who often played the role of a complex villain, including General Zod in the early Superman films, has died. He was 87. The London-born Stamp's six decades in the business were peppered with highlights, but it will be his portrayal of the bearded Zod in 1978 Superman and its sequel Superman II 2 years later that most people associate with Stamp. Well, that concludes the news from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette for Monday, August 18th. We will now take a short break and return with obituaries and features from a Living section.